Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
We're going to finish the chapter this morning. Reading Canto 3, Chapter 2, Texts 30. Thirty-one has no purport. 32 and 33 and 34 have no purport. So we'll read 30 through 34. This is Uddhava remembering Krishna in Vrindavan. The first three verses are demon-killing remembrances. And he concludes the chapter. Govardhan Leela is mentioned. The Rasalila is mentioned. So Uddhava starts speaking about the Mayina, or the great wizards, the Kamsa's buddies. They had mystic perfections. They could assume various forms. Sariputta would call them shape-changing demons. By mystic power, they could do that. So, in the verse and purport, Prabhupada has translated this as wizards. The great wizards, who were able to assume any form, were engaged by the king of Bhoja, Kamsa, to kill Krishna. But in course of his pastime, the Lord killed them, as easily as a child breaks dolls. So we've had some nice metaphors. One's a covered flame. One is a playful cub. Now here is a child breaking dolls. I'll read the purport, but the point that Prabhupada is making here is this wizardry of the demons made them feel invincible. It made Kamsa feel very safe and secure because he had invincible wizards like Marich for Ravan. So they thought, small child, push over. They were defeated. And that's not the way by which one can become perfect by mystic power. Rather, the processes of perfection gradually take one to the stage of bhakti, and in that stage of bhakti, it's not that one becomes equal to God. That aspiration of becoming God or equal to God is what brings one to the material world. It's not what takes one out of the material world. Purport. The atheist Kamsa wanted to kill Krishna just after his birth. He failed to do so. But later on, he got information that Krishna was living in Vrindavan at the house of Nanda Maharaj. He therefore engaged many wizards who could perform wonderful acts and assume any form they liked. All of them appeared before the childlike Lord in various forms, like Agabaka, Putana, Shakata, Trinavarta, Denuka, Kartabha, and they tried to kill the Lord at every opportunity. But one after another, all of them were killed by the Lord as if he was only playing with dolls. Children play with toy lions, elephants, boars, and many other similar dolls which are broken by the children in the course of their playing with them. Before the Almighty Lord, any powerful living being is just like a toy lion in the hands of a playing child. No one can excel God in any capacity, therefore, no one can be equal to or greater than him, nor can anyone attain the stage of equality with God by any kind of endeavor. Gyan, yoga, and bhakti are three recognized processes of spiritualization. The perfection of such processes can lead one to the desired goal of life in spiritual value. But that does not mean that one can attain perfection equal to the Lord's by such endeavors. It seems to be the the materialists, the main message here, the materialists are competing. They want to be enjoyers of the property of God, and they fail. So they want to become spiritualists or liberationists and become equal to God and compete with him in that way. That's also not possible. Or they become mystics and compete with him in that way, and that's also not possible. So the perfection is not to become equal to, as is commonly thought, become one with the Supreme. Become one with the Supreme. Become equal to the Supreme. Become the Supreme. That's not the perfection of such processes. The Lord is the Lord at every stage. When he was playing just like a child on the lap of his mother, Yashoda Mayi, or just like a cowherd boy with his transcendental friends, he continued to remain God without the slightest diminution of his six opulences. Thus, he is always unrivaled. So the Vrindavan pastimes is the subject, and in the Vrindavan pastimes, seemingly childlike behavior, little boy in the lap of his mother, little boy going into the forest with his friends playing games, little boy herding the cows in the Vaishya family, little boy going to school, little boy, little Krishna, seemingly quite human. Then when the extra human activities are presented, then that bewilders people. Then it becomes mythology or poetic imagination or something in their minds. Or compete, the mystics. How much opulence, how much mystic power does Krishna have? Uddhava's concerned about that, ordinary people won't understand. And that's, they'll think of Krishna as ordinary because they're ordinary. And that bothers him. It brings him pain. And our commentary here is advising us to rid ourselves of that idea also. Text 31 has no purport. It reads, "The inhabitants of Vrindavan were perplexed by great difficulties because a certain portion of the Yamuna was poisoned by the chief of the reptiles, Kaliya. The Lord chastised the snake king within the water and drove him away. And after coming out of the river, he caused the cows to drink the water and proved that the water was again in its natural state. No purport. The Supreme Lord Krishna desired to utilize the opulent financial strength of Maharaj Nanda for worship of the cows. And also he wanted to give a lesson to Indra, the king of heaven. Thus he advised his father to perform the worship of Go, or the pasturing land and the cows, with the help of learned brahmanas. So there's mention of, in the purport of both, the value of worship of cows and the the absence of the necessity of worshiping demigods. And then he discusses why is worship of the demigods there if it's not necessary? Why is it there to begin with? And his conclusion is it's there to begin with so it will help people accept in principle a superior power, superior authority, and gradually come to the position of acceptance of the Supreme Lord. For those that won't surrender to the Supreme Lord because they're in the material world, they're rebellious of the Supreme Lord. So they'll accept some other authority that will give them benedictions, so it encourages them in the direction of accepting higher authority towards accepting the Supreme Authority once again. But he repeats three times, it's not necessary. It's for people who have forgotten the supremacy of the Lord. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Since Krishna is the teacher of everyone, the Lord also taught his father, Nanda Maharaj. Nanda Maharaj was a well-to-do landowner, an owner of many cows, and as was the custom, he used to perform yearly worship of Indra, king of heaven, with great opulence. The worship of demigods by the general populace is also advised in the Vedic literature. Why? Just so that people can accept the superior power of the Lord. The demigods are servants of the Lord, deputed to look after the management of various activities of universal affairs. Therefore, it is advised in the Vedic scriptures that one should perform yajnas to appease the demigods. But one who is devoted to the Supreme Lord has no need to appease the demigods. Worship of the demigods by common people is an arrangement. Now it's stated again. It's an arrangement for acknowledgement of the supremacy of the Supreme Lord, but it is not necessary. Such appeasement is generally recommended for material gains only. As we have already discussed in the second canto of this literature, one who admits the supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not need to worship the secondary demigods. So the second canto, and here in the third canto, emphasis is given to Bhagavan. This is Bhagavat's Purana. So making the proper distinction between the demigods and the personality of Godhead is to be expected. So in the second canto, there's a long list. If one wants this, one wants health, one worships the sun. One wants wealth, one worships the goddess of fortune. One wants political power, one worships the Ashwini Kumaras. One wants this. Long list. It's not exhaustive because the desires of the living entity are practically unlimited, but it's a menu of desires, and if you want, then there's this worship. the conclusion after all of that list is, however, all of these are being fulfilled by the personality of Godhead, and if one simply takes shelter of the personality of Godhead, all of one's desires are fulfilled. And then akama sarvakamova mokshakama udaradi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param is being presented, that in all circumstances just engage in bhakti, worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So for one who worships the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this secondary demigods worship is not necessary because it's already included in worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Or say it the other way around, that the purpose behind the worship of the demigods is ultimately to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And not being willing to accept the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there's other apparent reasons, and that is the fulfillment of desires. This desire, this demigod, that demigod. And it works. So people, because it works, people have faith. Wow, it works. Without the recognition of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they become, their faith becomes strong in their particular approach, their particular worship. And Krishna's advice is not to disturb the minds of those who have such faith. While saying that, at the same time, Krishna is making it very clear in Bhagavad Gita what that worship is. It's avidhi. It's without proper understanding. And he's giving the proper understanding. So we can follow that approach that Krishna is using. We don't necessarily tell people, don't do this or don't do that. Just worship Krishna. We can say just worship Krishna, but anyway, how to approach persons that have some other type of worship is a delicate matter. Here, the way that Prabhupada is presenting it is, it's not necessary. It has a purpose, and the purpose is served by demigod worship, but it's not necessary. One who admits the supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead does not need to worship the secondary demigods. Sometimes, being worshipped and adored by less intelligent living beings, the demigods become puffed up with power, and they forget the supremacy of the Lord. When this happens, this happened when Lord Krishna was present in the universe, and therefore the Lord wanted to give a lesson to the King of Heaven, Indra. He asked Maharaj Nanda to stop the sacrifice offered to Indra and to use the money properly by performing a ceremony, worshipping the cows and the pasturing ground on the hill of Govardhan. By this act, Lord Krishna taught human society, as he instructed in Bhagavad Gita also, that one should worship the Supreme Lord by all acts and by all their results. This will bring about the desired success. So it's not only not necessary, but Govardhan Lila is instead worship Krishna, or here, worship the cows and the land upon which the cows are grazing, Govardhan Hill, because Govardhan is also Krishna. The concluding part, the Vaishyas are specifically advised to give protection to the cows and their pasturing ground or agricultural land instead of squandering their hard-earned money. that will satisfy the Lord. The perfection of one's occupational duty, whether in the sphere of duty to oneself, one's community, or one's nation, is judged by the degree to which the Lord is satisfied. So by his pastimes, Krishna is showing that. This is Uddhava's recollection of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. Although it was seemingly very playful and very childish. Father, this worship that the family has been doing for generations and generations and generations, you don't need to do this. We're dependent not upon Indra, we're dependent upon the cows and Govardhan Hill, where the cows are grazing. So take everything and worship the cows and Govardhan Hill. So his father did. And to show the residents of Vrindavan and his father that it wasn't just child talk. He manifested a giant form of Hari and accepted everything that they offered. Wonderful pastime. Demigod worship is performed with great opulence and pomp and splendor, and you know, compared to how modern degraded society will do what they do with great expense, you know, Mardi Gras, and even here in State College, you know, the big fair, there's nothing spiritual about it at all. There's so much money and so much energy and so much expenditure, and what spiritual elevation do people get from it? So the demigod worship is, you know, it's a grand festival and everybody participates and all opulence is used to worship Indra. It's fabulous. But what to speak if the same is used to worship Krishna, or those who have the Vaishya duty worship the cows, and it brings spiritual elevation. That even that the sense of it is like that, and worshiping Govardhan Hill. So the degree to which one has achieved perfection, because this was mentioned in the previous purport also. What perfection isn't you become equal to God. Perfection is that one's relationship with God becomes clearly established. And here, the perfection of one's occupational duty, whether in the sphere of one's duty to oneself, one's community, or one's nation, is judged by the degree to which the Lord is satisfied. And the last two verses, without purport, 33, O sober Vidura, King Indra, his honor having been insulted, poured water incessantly on Vrindavan, and thus the inhabitants of Vraja, the land of cows, were greatly distressed, but the compassionate Lord Krishna saved them from danger by his pastime umbrella, the Govardhan Hill. In the third season of the year, the Lord enjoyed as the central beauty of the assembly of women by attracting them with his pleasing songs in an autumn night brightened by moonshine. So he's speaking of the Rasa Lila, pastimes of the Lord, only mentioned in a brief way. This is third canto. More will be discussed later in the 10th canto. Uddhava is just giving a little perk, a little prompt. Discussion, comments. Yes.
Krishna, I have confusion about demigod worship. What about the ones that accept demigods as supreme lord? Aren't they based on the same shastra that we accept? Or what's there that makes this?
What was the last part? What's there?
What's there in the shastras that makes this confusion?
That makes the confusion. Well, there's different types of confusion. One type of confusion is pantheism. There's many gods. And where that many gods idea comes from, the short of it is, it's taking something without the whole picture. So the something can be a description of Brahma, Vishnu, and Mahesh, which is common. So flowing from that, if you have three, then you why not have more than three? So the more than three idea seems to be supported, not specifically saying that this one is supreme and that one is supreme, but the pantheon of demigods is that there's this kind of worship and that kind of worship and that kind of worship and that kind of worship. So much worship of so many different kinds, and therefore on the authority of the Vedas there's many gods. It's by inference, it's not by explicit statement. This is the supreme, this is the supreme, this is the supreme. Another is that many people don't have the strength or even the desire to search out the Supreme. They're simply wanting their desires fulfilled, and this works. And it's religious. It's, acknowledging some authority above me, and I'm approaching that authority above me, and I'm getting my desires fulfilled, and so it's doesn't require much effort to understand, well, what's supreme here. And another is simply the aversion, that the very nature of coming to this material world is based upon aversion of accepting the supreme. Wanting to be an enjoyer separate from the Supreme. So there's an aversion to accepting the Supreme. But it's easier if there's many, that I don't have some like very strong obligation to one place or another place. I can just kind of hedging. A little here, a little there. But some persons are very ardent worshippers, and they become ardent worshippers in part because they get some result. It works. And so that strengthens their faith. And from within, Krishna specifically says, I give them the faith. So it's not necessarily the notion that Ganesh is supreme or Lord Shiva is supreme, although they may think that way also. More commonly is the pantheon idea. or multi-gods. But some persons certainly think Shiva is supreme, and their faith is very strong, and they get some result, and that gives them the encouragement. And there are Puranas that give descriptions that appear to them to indicate Lord Shiva is supreme. This is described in Tattva Sandarbha, that when the Puranas were composed by Vyas, he composed them according to the understanding that there are persons influenced by ignorance, or persons influenced by passion, or persons influenced by goodness. And the Puranas support that faith, or that particular influence. It resonates well with that particular influence. And in those, there are narrations where there's something that goes on, a combat, or something that goes on where Lord Shiva is victorious, or Brahma is victorious, Brahma is supreme. It supports their faith. Why is it there? It supports their faith. It's nurturing their faith to go further. Embedded within those Puranas are sattvic statements also that indicate that the Vishnu is supreme, but they're not exclusive. There's some others, and so they go to those others because that inspires their mode of nature. At the same time, it connects them with some worship. So that's what's being described here. That's to help them come to the stage of accepting some authority, and through the acceptance of some authority that's Vedic, gradually, lifetimes perhaps, coming to the stage where becoming devotees of Lord Vishnu in the quality of goodness becomes possible for them. Otherwise, they won't do anything. They'll just very quickly become degraded without any elevating connection. For starters, the passion is fruitive. I do this, I get that. It's a business deal. Passion, fruitive. And that's what inspires me. If I didn't get that, I don't know if I'll do this. Fruitive. Or, in some cases, sacrifice of animals. You know, inflicting suffering and pain so I can get something. Destruction so I can get something. And without proper knowledge, that's another ignorance. Without proper knowledge of who I am, what's my real interest, what's going on, what's supreme? Ignorance. But it's a step. There's several components to that step. One component is accepting something above me, rather than I'm just an animal and it's just me. However strong I am, that's whatever I am. But there's something stronger than me, and I'm turning to that something stronger than me. And there's connection to a brahmana. A brahmana is to be in the quality of goodness. So by contact with that Brahman, I become elevated. And the whole process is Vedic, so I'm contacting, although indirectly, I'm contacting Narayana, because the Vedas come from Narayana. I'm getting elevated and elevated and elevated. And then thinking about what happens beyond the moment into the future situation, ultimately to a heavenly planet, a heavenly destination. It's life beyond this life. So what about the life that's beyond this life? What about, what is it that's living beyond this life? It elevates one's conception to the eternal soul. So then wanting to know more about the eternal soul. So the Gyan portion of the Vedic literatures through those other lower elevations that were primarily fruitive and material acquisition and gain to further cultivation of knowledge. See, depending upon the fork in the road and which way one goes, one can just try to become one with the Supreme. Or one can recognize, that's not, I can't be equal to the Supreme. I can have a relationship with He who is the Supreme. So it's elevating persons who are willing to be regulated by the codes of the Vedas, and it elevates them by that regulation, by that submission to the regulation. That's why it's there. And it's also reality, how the universe functions. There are controlling personalities. And one approaches them, they may be very merciful and assist you in ways that they have empowerment to do so. Something.
I had a question while cultivating relationships with people in office in a way so that they get favored to devotional service. Is it okay, or is it okay if we like sometimes involve with them in mundane talks, like so just to develop relationships or familiarity with them?
Bhaktivinoda Thakur addresses this specifically in Bhakti Aloka, and for householders who have occupations where they're mixing with worldly people, and on the prajalpa category, you know, he's discussing in Bhakti Loka, for being polite and social convention, householders may do like that. He doesn't drill on it or dwell on it. He just mentions that, you know, that for being polite and social convention, that may be done, and it's not harmful. If one dwells there, then it becomes harmful. And it's not taking their association, it's just being polite, socially polite. So, The confidential topics, one of his expressions is that confidential topics, that is, you know, what's really important, we don't have dialogue with those persons or take their advice about what's really important. Hello, sir, how are you? Have a nice day. And cordial exchange. But we don't dwell there. Unless, you know, in the course of those interactions, we see that the person has some, at least curiosity about spiritual topics, what to speak of, perhaps some genuine interest in spiritual topics. Well, here's a nice example to refer to. When Prabhupada was staying at the Agarwal's home in Butler, Pennsylvania, right? She commented that Swamiji never made us feel uncomfortable. He would speak about whatever. And very quickly the conversation would go to something spiritual, but he would speak as about, you know, whatever was the weather and whatever was going on. Bridge, little boy, and mundane. But he would go to some, because that was his consciousness, it went to something, some spiritual topic. But she never felt uncomfortable. She was being judged, or, oh, I can't talk to you because you're just mundane. He was a guest in their home. That was a little different than being in the workplace. Still, there's some, when you're like, one has to be socially aware of what the circumstances require. The most compelling thing that I've seen, the two most compelling things, is the qualities that the devotees have in comparison to the qualities of those who aren't devotees of Krishna, that have worship of this and worship of that, are compelling. More than what you might say to them is your qualities. That speaks volumes. People notice the difference. At least, you know, sensitive people notice the difference. And the other is when they experience the Sangha of Vaishnavas, you know, how the Vaishnavas conduct themselves when they're with one another is very, very, very different than how those who are engaged in demigod worship, it's primarily social. You know, there's some reverence when the puja, etc., is being conducted, it's going on. As soon as that's over, it's social. And not necessarily very elevated socially either. Polite, but, you know, very mundane. And in contrast, the devotees have so much understanding, as well as qualities, and, you know, that they're the depth of interaction is distinct. So it may be better, depending upon the circumstance, but it may be better to let persons ask you questions rather than you know, make them understand, as you said.
Even if they ask questions, how can you can't be direct? Like,
depends on the person. Depends on the relationship with the person, also. A common question, or the type of question people will ask, is, why do you just worship Krishna? Why not as we're doing? So, one small step is to say, well, have you read Bhagavad Gita? Are you familiar with Bhagavad Gita? Do you accept Bhagavad Gita? And if they say, yes, I accept Bhagavad Gita, you can go another big step quickly. Because in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks about the question you're asking. And do you know what Krishna says? You accept Bhagavad Gita. Do you know what Krishna says? Oh, I don't know what Krishna says. Krishna says, yeah, it's all one. That's what I read. I read it's all one. And, you know, demigod worship is very nice. That's what I read. Because they didn't really read it. So, you know, you go for a little gentle walk with them down the path of chapter 7, chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna speaks about demigod worship. Let's go there. There's a few verses in chapter 7. Here's what Krishna says. Then some in chapter 9, here's what Krishna says. Oh, really? So then you can back up a little bit and say, here's a nice metaphor. The metaphor of watering a tree. You can water the branches and roots and, or the branches and twigs and flowers and the limbs of the tree, or you can just water the root of the tree. And this is in Bhagavat Purana. Just put water in the root of the tree. And just worship Krishna. Because what? Then you go back. Chapter 7, Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says this. Chapter 9, he says that. And then there's the banyan tree example. You know that one from Bhagavad Gita? So the banyan tree, the hymns are the leaves of the banyan tree. So the hymns of the Vedas, the worship of the demigods, that's like, you know, the leaves. But then there's the root. So the whole of the Vedic process is find the root of existence and then give your attention there. When you're giving your attention to the root of all of existence is benefited. Myself included and yourself included and everything. So we just, that's why. Then you're not like twisting their arm saying, you know, why are you doing this? You're wasting your time, or, you know, they don't feel put down. Just, you know, you've asked, so here's an explanation. So the entry point, if you want to, if you feel it's appropriate, if they ask, why don't you do this? Why are you only doing worshiping Krishna? So you start with, you're familiar with Bhagavad Gita, right? You accept everybody accepts the authority of Bhagavad Gita, right? And as soon as they say that, yes, I accept the authority of Bhagavad Gita. Then, rather than telling them, you ask them, what does it say in Bhagavad Gita about the question you just asked? Because Krishna and Arjuna speak about it. And then they'll tell you something that it doesn't say in Bhagavad Gita, that it says in Bhagavad Gita. Then rather than, so just slowly, gently, step by step, paraphrase it or actually physically take the book out and read what it says. Then in your own words explain it, or without the referring directly, just paraphrase and summarize. Then this nice metaphor, trees, and then the banyan tree. So that, you know, that's an upside down picture of a banyan tree. But actually there is a root. It's different than the leaves and branches. You put water there. So that's why we just do this. It's a nice understanding. Well, gee, if that's such a simple, straightforward understanding, why are people doing this other thing? Why is it even there? was your question. It's good to honor someone above us. The Vedas are teaching us that we should do that. And that's good. Oh, well, if it's good, then how come you're not doing it? I am, by worshiping Krishna. And all things are accomplished by that. And you know what our teaching is? That we should worship Krishna, at least strive to worship Krishna, not for getting something back. Really? Not for getting something back? I mean, you have so many things that you need, yeah. We don't have to worry about the so many things that we need. When you have a loving father, you don't have to go ask your loving father for something you need, or your mother. They're there taking care of whatever you need. Just part of that loving relationship. So we don't have to ask for things that we need. We just ask for doing something for them. That's nice. And simple, you know, that's the teaching that really inspires me, and I'm following that. I find it very satisfying. Likely it's, oh, that's interesting, and then they just continue with what their program is. So if you, there's, the first part of your question is how do we make them understand, and I would say the language is mistaken. You know, you can't make somebody understand something. You can inspire them to want to understand something by your example and your good qualities. And if they're open to understand, then the next question is how do you address when they ask? Yes. Hi, Krishna.
I've seen that whenever a curse is given on Krishna, there is a reason behind it. He has some transcendental reason. For Govardhanji, I heard that there is a curse that he's shrinking in size. Could you please tell us, like, what is the essence behind that curse?
You can't curse Krishna and have it be effective. Rather, what the Vrijbasis say is when Govardhan is shrinking, it's out of separation. Previously, Krishna was on the side of Govardhan Hill walking with his cows and Balaram and all the cowherd boys. Krishna's gone. He's shrinking out of separation from Krishna. Yes.
You have been talking about the principle-centered living yesterday. Can you just give me some of the principles that I can base on?
Sadhana. Relationships, the immediate relationships, particularly immediate relationships, meaning where Krishna is principally coming through descending channel, through spiritual master and those representing Srila Prabhupada very nicely. And your immediate circle of friends, that with the view that Krishna should be pleased, not just that I feel good, but Krishna should be pleased by by how you're conducting yourself in those relationships. Those are principles. Another is that what you do, like, you know, the psychophysical nature topic from yesterday evening, what you do to learn, do that for Krishna. Just like the point that was being made here, that the success is measured by how much Krishna is pleased. The perfection of one's occupational duty, whether in the sphere of duty to oneself, one's community, or one's nation, is judged by the degree to which the Lord is satisfied. Learn that art. Important principle. That takes time, because we're very conditioned to a whole other paradigm, fruitive paradigm. That's a good beginning. Keep you busy for a lifetime at least. Okay. Thank you very much. You have something else?
On the psychophysical.
Okay.
Like yesterday you were answering that we can use it, the psychophysical nature, to like the medical practitioner example, that they can think about the how it is actually useful. But in some certain circumstances, Maharaj, I saw, like, when we think in that way, I mean, primary thing that comes out is we are doing everything for money. Or at least, like, for example, I'm studying, and if I'm working for the defense, I mean...
Okay, so... Now, this is a big topic. Big topic. But make it short and simple. At least, when you're in that work atmosphere, that you're Krishna's little emissary. You're Krishna's representative in that outpost. And you're an example of bhakti, of Krishna bhakti. You're showing the people by example, this is how one can live one's life in devotion to Krishna, even in a circumstance like this. And that the fruits of one's work are not for enjoyment, they're for service to Krishna. Minimally that. And another is, at the advanced stage of your career, it's not so easy to press the reset button, because so many years of preparation have brought you to a certain stage. But when you're advising others, you can, you know, hit the reset button to consider, so that you can more immediately connect with what you're doing and how it's of service to Krishna. Give thought to it. You know, young people today especially are extremely mindful. I did this of making a difference. You know, social activism is the phrase that's used. I forget where I was. Somewhere. Yeah, I remember now. Is at Arvind's home with his two teenage sons, and, you know, the husband and wife were there, and their kids. So, to demonstrate, I asked, in the presence of his father, I asked two questions. Who has more stress growing up, your father or you? And surveys show he gave the same answer that this year I do. And then the question was, why? There's so many expectations of standard of living and excellence and this and that, you know, and I can't even live my life because I have so many expectations just thrust upon me before I even get started. Stressful. Then the next is, when you think about career, what's the primary thing that you think about when you think about career? And he didn't use the words make a difference, but that was what he was saying. It's not how much money I'll make, or I'm good at science and math, or something about, you know, me. It's about service orientation. Concern about, you know, what the future of the planet is going to be and the quality of life of people. And there's a very strong orientation like that. So that's, you know, whatever their psychophysical nature is, it's largely sociological, how they're thinking. It was very different for the previous two decades, called the me generation. You know, in the Western countries at least, you know, Europe and America. So, from your own experience, you can help persons when you're guiding them how they're going to decide what their careers are going to be. Think about it. And from your own, you know, if there's something within the field that you are presently involved in, that over the period of the next 5 to 10 years you can move in this direction or that direction that can connect you more with a sense of how I'm going to be able to serve Krishna, you know, through the work that I'm doing day to day. Maybe there's something that you can do, because you can't redo the past 20 years of your life. That's, you know, you've moved in a certain path by decisions that were previously made. You know, it's like putting the plant near the window, and that over a period of time the plant will start growing towards the light. That's the principle. So go near where the light is and watch your career grow, because decisions will be made going into the future. Part of it is circumstantial, but part of it is also decisions that are made. Yeah? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Jai. Jai.